I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at how North Carolina is dealing with COVID-19 and what we're learning about ourselves in the face of a global crisis. Today, protests, police brutality, and the pandemic.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
Across the state and across the country, from Raleigh to Minneapolis, Fayetteville to Los Angeles, we've seen cities decimated by a militarized police response to peaceful protests and indiscriminate and persistent looting. These events, sparked by yet another killing of a black man by a uniformed police officer and caught on camera, are also fueled by historic and long-standing violence and institutional inequalities perpetrated against black Americans. Inequalities that have been illuminated by the pandemic's death toll. Reverend William Barber delivered what he calls a pastoral letter to the nation on Sunday.
Black Americans have rarely been able to sustain such illusions that racism is just a few bad actors. Deadly racism is always with us, and not only through police brutality. In the midst of the current pandemic, we are painfully aware that our families bear a disproportionate burden of COVID-19 deaths.
The burden Reverend Barber speaks of is stark in our state. African Americans are 34% of all COVID deaths here in North Carolina, where they make up 22% of the total population. The economic burden of the COVID crisis is also being felt more severely in the black community. Black workers are less likely to have jobs that allow them to work from home and are overrepresented in low-paying jobs that provide less economic security. These disparities, of course, began centuries before the current pandemic.
Even before COVID, large numbers of black Americans died because of the racial disparities in healthcare, not because of their race, but the racial disparities, the systemic racism, which are systemic and not unintentional.
Until black people cease to be dehumanized and objectified and vilified in this nation, we're never going to move forward. So for me, it was just all about affirming our humanity as a people.
America's systemic racism was one of the reasons Breanna Baker decided to attend a protest in Raleigh Saturday afternoon. She's a public health analyst for RTI International, located in the Triangle. Her research focuses on psychological resilience in marginalized communities.
And how communities and individuals of color remain adaptable and overcome adversity that they experience.
Breanna acknowledges that protesting in a large crowd poses serious health risks amidst a pandemic. But she says the fact that black Americans are more likely to bear the brunt of COVID-19 fuels an urgency to organize.
We have to organize now because we as a people are at a breaking point. You know, you can't tell a black person who has dealt with racial discrimination their entire lives to take a back seat, put their feelings and personhood on the back burner and wait for some all clear from the government. You know, we're angry now and we're ready to make effective, sustainable change. And this is our opportunity to do that. And then I would say the last reason that this is imperative right now is because America has made clear that COVID-19 and being black in this country can both cost you your life. And frankly, I'd rather lose my last breath fighting for overdue justice for my community. So I think that summarizes the significance of these demonstrations amidst a global pandemic. Justice for black lives transcends any physical or systemic weapon formed against us.
While social unrest feels compounded by a mix of the pandemic and police brutality, Duke University professor William Darity says we've been here before.
I don't think the pandemic has played into the response of black Americans, because this is a response that frequently follows police atrocities.
Darity is the director of the Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke. He's also the co-author of a new book called From Here to Equality: Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century. And his research has greatly influenced a growing movement calling for reparations for American descendants of slaves. Darity says if you look at the protests today compared to the ones that took place in the 1960s, you'll see some similarities and some things that are strikingly different.
If we think about the wave of uprisings that took place in the 1960s, virtually every one of those instances, apart from the response to Martin Luther King's assassination, were associated with police wrongdoing of some sort. That seems to be the key trigger, from my perspective, for Black American outrage and responses of this type.
So does this seem or feel any different than any of those events?
In the 60s, the damages and destruction largely took place within segregated Black communities, particularly in urban areas. And this time, that doesn't seem to be so much the case. In point of fact, I saw images of the White House being surrounded by fires. Nothing like that occurred in the uprisings in the 1960s. It has extended outside, far outside of the Black community. And it is not clear how much destruction has actually taken place within the Black community. I certainly don't think it's destruction to the degree that occurred in the 1960s. But, you know, in some ways, you might even argue that the rage has been channeled by Black people in a different way from the way in which it was channeled in the 1960s, and that the more destructive impulses have not come from Blacks at all. It feels like there's a difference in the way in which Black folks are expressing their discontentment in this moment than the way in which their discontentment was expressed in the 1960s.
What's still true from the 1960s to today is the higher percentage of African Americans who are in challenging socioeconomic situations. And you've advocated and worked tirelessly on a specific plan for reparations. And I wonder, as you watch these events unfold, do you think to yourself, if a reasonable and effective reparations plan had been put into effect years ago, could some of this have been avoided?
It could be avoided insofar as higher levels of Black financial resources and Black economic security, if those higher levels were associated with a greater degree of restraint and positive policing. And I'm not sure that a greater level of economic security on part of Black Americans necessarily ensures that the police will behave better. So I think we would need, in addition to the kinds of resources that reparations could provide, very active policies that are targeted at police behavior, including the denial of the police of military equipment. I mean, I think it's absolutely outrageous that police departments throughout the country have been able to arm themselves using the same equipment that the United States military deploys. So that would be an important step, and that would be a step that would need to be taken that's separate from the kinds of compensatory programs that would be associated with the reparations project.
Other than that, I mean, as you see these events unfold, whether they're socioeconomic policies or other things, are there things that could be implemented fairly soon or rather quickly that could help the situation?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly the case. And the process of wealth inequality, there's dramatic wealth inequality by race in the United States, to the point that Black Americans are about 13% of the country's population, but only have about 2.6% of the nation's wealth. And that corresponds to a condition where the average Black household has $800,000 less in net worth than the average white household. And certainly these kinds of resource differentials have tremendous implications for health outcomes, opportunities to get quality education, and potentially access to the system of criminal justice in a more equitable manner. Certainly, if you're wealthier, you can buy or purchase superior legal advice in dealing with the criminal justice system. So, yes, I would argue that a program of reparations could have an immense effect on current conditions. Although, as I pointed out, I'm not sure that that exclusively would address the problem of police brutality. But we could adopt a program of reparations for Black Americans overnight. There's nothing logistical that prevents that from happening. And that could make a terrific difference. If we were to eliminate racial wealth disparities in the United States, we would eliminate a host of accompanying inequalities that are a consequence of those kinds of financial gaps.
It also strikes me that if the African American community, you know, if their wealth grew, and you mentioned sort of access to better legal advice, but also wealthy have stronger control of the political power in this country.
Also, if we are thinking about participation in entrepreneurship, individuals who are wealthier can take more risks and take more risks without suffering a severe penalty if their business enterprises don't succeed. Wealthier people have a greater capacity to transfer resources to the next generation and make it possible for subsequent generations to have a more economically secure existence. Wealthier people can purchase their way into higher quality housing. They can ensure that their kids get high quality levels of education. There's so many opportunities that open up if you have adequate financial resources. I think, you know, you made the point that there is a line that can be drawn from the entire history of racial injustice in the United States to the present condition. But I think it's really important that we draw a line from the point of emancipation, when there was a promise of 4-acre land grants to the formerly enslaved, and it was a promise that was not kept. And this took place at the same time that many white Americans were receiving what we might actually refer to as handouts, if you like, of 160-acre land grants in the western part of the United States under the Homestead Acts. So on the one hand, you had the formerly enslaved who got nothing in the way of land resources. And then you got many, many whites who received substantial land grants that had effects on their capacity to transfer wealth across generations. And I think what's really striking about the present moment, particularly the response to the coronavirus crisis, is we now have evidence that the question of how will you pay for these things really can be taken off the table. It's very clear that the federal government has the capacity to fund almost anything it so desires to fund without virtual limit. The only limitation that I would identify for additional federal spending is the inflation risk. And so any new expenditure program has to be designed keeping in mind that there's a need to make sure that you contain inflation. But when we're in a depression like we are in the current moment, there's very little inflationary pressure in the economy. And so higher levels of federal expenditure for any type of program becomes much more feasible than it would be in a situation where the economy was in more prosperous times.
Professor William Darity is the director of the Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity at Duke University. What he had to say about the ways for our government to balance the scale, fill in the wealth gap, and immediately address racial disparities is a striking thought. That major change at the federal level to benefit Black Americans is possible now, and upending what we thought, that the struggle for civil rights has to be a long, seemingly unending fight. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Dave DeWitt. Charlie Shelton Ormond is our producer. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. Thanks for listening. See you next time.